Hi. Thanks to the organizers for putting together this conference. I'm really excited to be here today in Waterloo. I'm Emily, and I'm a grad student in Monica Schleyer-Smith's lab at Stanford. Today I'll be talking about a cold atom cavity QED experiment where we're starting to explore engineering programmable spin interactions with atoms and photons. So experimentalists like me work really hard in the lab all the time to push the limits on generating highly coherent and specific interactions between quantum particles. So these can be cold atoms, ions, superconducting qubits, and so forth. This work has paid off. Quantum computing startups are popping up like daisies. They're generating really exciting results, like this recent demonstration of estimating the ground state energy of a water molecule from ion Q. We've also seen progress in metrology, where entangled spin squeeze states can beat classical precision limits on phase detection. And we've seen that quantum simulators built with optical lattices and tweezers can, for example, study ground states of various Hamiltonians, such as in this result from a tweezer experiment in Misha Lukin's group at Harvard, where they study this Z234 spatial ordering transition. And this is, of course, by no means an exhaustive list. So as the number of these experiments increases, and as they grow more and more robust and complicated, they're generating increasingly unwieldy amounts of quantum data, which is clearly a situation that calls for the use of machine learning. So for me, the ultimate goal is to be able to take some data generated from my experiment. These are random pictures selected from my lab wiki. And I want to feed it into some AI, and I want it to label everything and tell me what everything is. And I want to give me the result and tell me if there's anything interesting or useful in my data set or not. Okay. So I've divided machine learning into two broad categories of usefulness for experimentalists. In the first category, we're using machine learning to look at physics that's actually contained in the data being generated, such as recognizing and classifying different kinds of order in the system. So there are already good examples of this in cold atom experiments. For example, in the Weidenberg group, they used a neural network to identify a superfluid versus Mott insulator phase transition. And Michael Knapp's group used a neural network to classify snapshots of a doped Hubbard model according to two different theoretical ideas of the underlying state. Recently, data from the Harvard experiment that I just mentioned was used to perform state tomography. So this idea was originally inspired from this paper, and they were able to perform tomography on the Z2 ordered state and use the reconstruction to estimate observables that the experimentalists couldn't actually measure. In the second category, machine learning is used as a tool for experimentalists to improve experimental control. So this group in Australia demonstrated the use of machine learning to speed up their optimization of BEC evaporation, and machine learning has also been used in both quantum gas microscopes and in trapped ion experiments to improve the fidelity of readout. Okay, so my aim today is basically to discuss many of the exciting capabilities of my experiment, and then hopefully we'll see how machine learning can tie into either the data that we're generating or the experimental sequence that we're running. Specifically, today I'll be doing this in the context of explaining how we implement a family of continuously tunable Heisenberg spin models, where the coupling here is over all pairs of spins I and J. So it's not just between neighbors. So we really have a complete graph of interactions between all of the spins. I'll explain how to tune the anisotropy alpha, which captures the relative weight of the Ising and spin exchange terms. And I'll also describe how to tune the set of couplings Ji in order to break this all-to-all coupling symmetry and create a more interesting distance-dependent structure. Okay, so the all-to-all structure in this coupling graph is obtained very naturally from the photon-mediated interactions in our experiment. And I'll highlight that these interactions are non-local, so they don't decay with distance as opposed to a contact or a dipole interaction. And I'd also like to point out that these interactions are tunable, which again is very different than the couplings that you would find in a material system. So we can actually change the strength and the sign of the interactions dynamically during the experiment and even switch them on and off. And we can do this simply by changing the frequency or amplitude of a drive field. Okay, so I'm going to start by talking a little bit about our platform. Each atom is a spin one system, and the three spin states are Zeeman levels. They're split by roughly a megahertz. We couple to the optical cavity using the 780 nanometer optical transition in rubidium, but we're mostly very far detuned from the excited states, so we can really just pay attention to the dynamics in this spin one subspace. The atoms are pinned in place by a lattice inside the cavity, and they're coupled to the cavity mode at 780 nanometers with a coupling strength G, which is the vacuum Rabi frequency. So if we want to drive interactions between the atoms, we turn on a laser, and very roughly what happens is that one atom can absorb a photon from the drive field, re-emit into the cavity mode, and then any other atom that's coupled to the cavity can reabsorb that photon. We'd like for these interactions to be as coherent as possible, so we want the atoms to exchange the photon many, many times before it's lost, which can happen via free space scattering, which happens with a coupling gamma. And the photon can also be lost to the cavity mirrors, which happens with some coupling kappa, the cavity line width. The single atom cooperativity eta basically sums up the ratio of the coherence to the dissipation in the system. And in our experiments, we're working with an eta of roughly 7. So this is a picture of the cavity. Took me 2 years to build. These are the mirrors. And we trap and cool the atoms between the mirrors in roughly the center. Our readout mechanism is fluorescence imaging. So we shine some light in from the side, and then we collect the fluorescence from below with a high numerical aperture lens. And we end up with an image on the CCD camera that looks like this. So as you can see, the long axis here is the cavity axis, and the cloud is very thin in the transverse direction. So we have spatial resolution of some of the degrees of freedom along the cavity axis, but also, as you can see, we don't have single atom resolution like the quantum gas microscope and tweezer experiments. In each experiment, we actually image the three spin states separately. So this is a false color image of one camera shot from one experiment. And you can see that the three spin states are separated. And basically, what we measure in every experimental shot are population differences between these three spin states, and we have resolution of this along the cavity axis, as I said earlier. Since we don't have single atom resolution, we usually cut our cloud into bins of some chosen size, and then in each bin, we add up the individual atoms and form one large collective spin vector, capital F. We normally like to picture this large picture, this large spin vector on a Bloch sphere, and it has radius F, and the spin vector is defined by some direction on the Bloch sphere. In particular, I'll be talking a lot today about the phase in the XY plane phi. In the experiment, we always measure population differences, so our images are projective measurements of FZ. But we can actually perform a rotation before the image and measure the spin pointing along any direction. So initially, in our state preparation, we make all of the spins point down. And then we can perform arbitrary local rotations in each bin by scanning a focused Raman beam along the cloud. So we can basically choose the phase and the amplitude of the pulse in each bin to make the spin point along any direction that we want. So here it's pointing along the x-axis, here the y-axis, and so forth. Using our imaging capabilities, we can also verify that we have actually prepared the state correctly. So here I've plotted measurements of the spin component along the direction phi in the xy plane. In this data set on the left, we've prepared the atoms on the left pointing along the x-axis, and the atoms on the right pointing along the minus x-axis. And in the phase data, you can see that these populations are 180 degrees out of phase. In the data set on the right, we've prepared a slightly more complicated spin texture, minus x, x, y. Okay, so hopefully that gives you a good overview of our experimental capabilities. Now I'm going to discuss how we actually implement the Hamiltonian. In order to make the Heisenberg spin model, we exploit the Faraday effect, which is an interaction between the spin vector of the atoms in the cavity and the polarization of the light field inside the cavity. This interaction can be seen as both a atom spin dependent light shift of the cavity resonance and a light shift on the atoms that depends on the number of photons inside the cavity. The quantization axis for the spin is defined by some applied magnetic field B that we set during the experiment. Okay. So I'm first going to talk about how we make the spin exchange Hamiltonian. We first set the field to be perpendicular to the cavity axis. In this case, it's the x component of the spin that couples to the light field. The spin exchange will become more apparent if I rewrite the Hamiltonian in terms of horizontally polarized photons in the dry field and vertically polarized photons that are emitted into the cavity mode by the atoms. So the Hamiltonian contains terms like HV dagger F plus and HV dagger F minus, which correspond to the single spin Raman processes that flip the spin of one atom. The photon emitted into the cavity is immediately lost through the mirrors. But if we simply detune from this Raman resonance, then the photon, instead of being lost through the mirrors, is actually reabsorbed by another atom, completing this F minus, F plus spin exchange process between two of the atoms in the cavity. So here's some data that shows the spin exchange process that I just described. The x-axis is the long axis of the cavity, and each row is a picture of the spin texture after the atoms have been allowed to evolve for a time t. So here what we've done is prepared all the atoms in spin down, and then created an excitation on the left side of the cloud. And what you can see in this data set is that this excitation hops from the left side to the right side, back to the left, back to the right, multiple times. This is a coherent and reproducible spatial oscillation of this spin excitation. And I really like this data set because it highlights the non-locality of the interactions in the cavity. So this excitation doesn't hop to the nearest neighbor, but rather hops to the atoms that are on the other side of the cavity, which in this data set is over a millimeter away. Thinking back to the mechanism for the spin exchange, you probably won't be surprised to see that the interaction strength depends on the detuning of the drive field from both cavity resonance and the two Raman resonances. So we predict this kind of behavior of the coupling, including these three sign flips. And now we'd like to actually measure this experimentally. So one way that we can do this is to use Raman addressing to prepare a state that evolves in a way that's very easy, that makes it very easy for us to extract the coupling coefficient as a function of the detuning. For this part, it's helpful to think about the Hamiltonian in a mean field picture. So we can think of a spin F as simply being coupled to some magnetic field, where in this case, the magnetic field is actually formed by summing over the spin vectors of all the other atoms in the cavity. So here, for example, if we were to prepare half of the atoms pointing along the x-axis and half of them pointing along the y-axis, then at time t equals 0, we should observe zero magnetization. But then as we allow the system to evolve under the spin exchange Hamiltonian, what we expect is that these spins will actually precess about each other, rotating into the z plane. And from the slope of this magnetization, we should be able to extract the spin exchange coupling. And if we change the sign of the spin exchange coupling, then we expect the direction of the rotation to change. So we actually measured this in the experiment. So here we've prepared roughly half the atom cloud pointing along the x-axis and roughly half pointing along the y-axis. At time t equals 0, you can see that the initial state has zero magnetization. And then as the system is allowed to evolve, we see the magnetization start to increase linearly at short times. And if we change the sign of the detuning, then the direction of this rotation reverses. Performing the above measurement at all of these detunings, we're basically able to confirm that the system behaves as we expect. I want to emphasize how interesting it is that we can actually change the sign of the interactions during the experiment. One really cool application of this is actually that you can reverse the direction of time in your experiment up to dissipation. Now I'll talk about the Ising term. So in this case, we set the field to point along the cavity axis, and it now couples to the z component of the spin. Here, the z component affects the cavity resonance frequency, which, if you're driving at a fixed frequency, changes the number of atoms of photons in the cavity. And the number of photons, in turn, affects the light shift on the atoms. Thus, this Hamiltonian describes an FZ-dependent light shift. And this is basically exactly the Ising interaction. I've plotted here the Ising interaction as a function of drive detuning. Once again, you'll notice that it changes sign at cavity resonance. We'd again like to prepare some kind of state that allows us to measure the Ising interaction and extract it very easily from our measurement. In this case, we prepare the state x minus z. And if you again think in this mean field picture, basically these two spins that are pointing along the x-axis will precess about this spin pointing along minus z. But nothing will happen to this z spin because the two spin components of the x spins cancel. So actually, even if our Hamiltonian does include a spin exchange component, that won't affect the dynamics here. So we can always directly just extract the Ising coupling from the time evolution of this spin texture. And once again, we expect the direction of the precession to change if we change the sign of the interaction. Yeah?
So I have a sort of a more, I guess, low-level question of what's the goal in engineering? You must have a goal that you're trying to go with. Maybe what you briefly mentioned was sign change in the Hamiltonian, which I guess was motivating, perhaps, that this sort of experiment will be able to let you measure out-of-time correlator, something like that. But you didn't mention anything about that, so I'm kind of trying to figure out. So you're giving us kind of description of how the experiments work, but you also tell us what's the vision. Where do you want to go with this?
Well, actually, the interesting thing about this experiment is that we can really do lots and lots and lots of things with it. So looking at scrambling, measuring out-of-time order correlators using the fact that we can change the sign of the interaction is only one possible application of the experiment. Another is, I guess it will come up later in the talk, we can make highly entangled states that are useful potentially for making very sensitive phase measurements in atomic clocks. and right now we're looking at a scheme where it would be possible to actually measure spatial variations in a magnetic field very sensitively, also using these interactions that I've been talking about. So really, the goal of the experiment is to make this highly tunable system where we can make an interesting Hamiltonian, and then we can use it for some of the applications that I mentioned.
But realizing interesting Hamiltonian is particularly interesting if you're realizing, let's say, a system that cannot be simulated, something like that, right?
So right now I'm talking about everything in a mean field picture because it's easy for us to extract the coupling coefficients there. But I mean, it is not possible for anybody to actually fully simulate the quantum dynamics of my experiment.
And you measure the dynamics?
It's possible to simulate the mean field dynamics, but if you want to fully include all of the higher order quantum terms, that is not possible.
But you can measure as a function of time. You're measuring dynamics.
Yes, I've been showing data showing dynamics, yeah. I guess another possible application of creating these Hamiltonians is that they're useful for solving computational problems, so like looking at the ground state. Even if just the Ising Hamiltonian is basically a mapping onto the NP-hard partition problem, where you try to divide a set of integers into two sets of equal weight, for example. So this is some data that actually shows the phase evolution that I just talked about. So here we've prepared the state x minus xz, and we've measured at two different detunings. You can see that the phase evolves as a function of time, as we predicted. And you might also notice some spatial dependence in the phase evolution that actually comes from the fact that the atoms are off cavity center, so the coupling is actually changing with a Lorentzian spatial dependence here. Actually, this spatial dependence of the couplings is another thing that makes the dynamics in our experiment very hard to simulate. In the uniform coupling case, it's in some cases easy to look numerically at simulations of the experiment. But in the case where all of the spins are not uniformly coupled to the cavity, it becomes much harder. By now you may have guessed that alpha is tunable by adjusting the angle theta between 0 and pi over 2 radians. So we performed the phase measurement at 6 different field angles, and we were able to extract the coupling coefficient as a function of the angle theta. This plot will eventually have more data points, and we're working in the lab to fill those in. Okay, so if I choose some field angle between 0 and pi over 2, then I can plot the Ising and spin exchange couplings together. And from this plot, you can actually see that we can access all four quadrants of relative sign between the two interactions, including the fully anti-ferromagnetic and ferromagnetic Heisenberg models, as well as the two cases where the spins are not the same, where the two signs are not the same. And hopefully soon in the lab, we'll actually start to look at the ground state via adiabatic ground state preparation. So we have a few ideas for applying machine learning to this data. The first is Hamiltonian tomography. We're currently preparing very specific and complicated initial states such that we can extract the coupling coefficients in the Hamiltonian very easily from the data. But there's kind of a whole phase space here that we can explore where we have state preparation complexity on the x-axis and data analysis complexity on the y-axis. And so one interesting possibility is to prepare some random initial state, but still be able to extract what the Hamiltonian was from the raw data. We've made some preliminary progress in this direction by training an RNN on some simulated data, and it's able to successfully predict the angle theta. A second possibility involves a theory paper from another student in the group, Greg Benson, where he basically shows that the dynamics of this model are mostly chaotic, except at two integral points. So one possibility would be to take data in these two regimes and classify it. And a second would be to extract conserved quantities from this data. A third possibility is to go beyond the mean field and actually look at quantum correlations that are in our data, but which we haven't actually paid any attention to yet. So I've really only been talking about this mean field theory. Okay, but speaking of quantum correlations, we've actually already seen them in our experiment in a slightly different context. So I'm now going to talk about how the same spin exchange Hamiltonian actually allows us to move beyond mean field and access a highly entangled state. So if we prepare all of the atoms in the MF equals zero state, then the F minus F plus spin exchange operator creates correlated pairs of atoms in plus and minus one. This is a state that has no vector spin component, and the ideas from earlier about mean field theory no longer apply. So we're really accessing the quantum behavior of the system. This is some raw data that shows the pair creation process happening in the experiment. Here we've prepared all the atoms in MF equals zero, and in some of the data you can see this correlated population increase in plus and minus one. The state we've created here is what's called a twin Fock state, which I've written for four atoms. And it's potentially metrologically useful. We can also plot the spatial correlation, and it's something that you could kind of already see by eye. But basically, there's a high amount of correlation where there are atoms and zero correlation where there are no atoms. And the uniformity of this correlation actually demonstrates really well the all-to-all coupling in our system because there's no spatial dependence in this correlation. But actually, we can break that symmetry by programming distance-dependent interactions. So I'm going to talk about how to do that now. All the physics I've been talking about so far has been in a uniform field. But if we actually try to drive the spin mixing in a magnetic field gradient, then I can no longer create pairs at large distances because this process no longer conserves energy. I can, however, turn on this coupling again by adding a second drive field to the laser frequency. And then I can basically turn on the interactions again at a coupling that I at a distance that I choose. There's no reason to stop at just two drive fields, so we can actually add, in principle, arbitrarily many, and control the coupling strength at the distances by simply adjusting the amplitude of fields. So this is preliminary data that does indeed show the spatial dependence of the interactions, where here we've driven pair creation in a magnetic field gradient. You would still expect to see local correlations, so we see them along this line here. And then we also see lobes popping up at the distance that corresponds to the sideband frequency. Okay, so some possibilities for using machine learning on this data are extracting, again, the interesting features in the spatial dependence and the time dependence of the correlation structure. I think there's a really interesting direction at looking at performing state tomography with data that doesn't actually have single atom resolution. So, for example, you might not be interested in performing full tomography on the state, but simply targeting observables of interest without single atom resolution. For example, in the twin Fock state, we're interested in measuring a very low variance in the SC component of the spin. That's the property of the state that makes it metrologically useful. We could also use extra information from the cavity light and local Raman readout for more combinations of different measurements and different bases. So we don't have to measure all of the spins in SC, we can perform local rotations and then measure SZ here, SX here, SY here, et cetera. Finally, I think another interesting direction would be distinguishing the quantum correlations from the classical noise in our detection. Okay, so I'll just throw up again the possibilities for machine learning that I already discussed in the previous section. And then I don't want to neglect the somewhat nebulous possibility of actually using the experiment itself for some kind of quantum machine learning application. I think a good example of an idea in this direction is the quantum convolutional neural network paper from Iris Kong, Soonwan Choi, and Michelle Lucan. And we're also interested in actively integrating machine learning into our data collection, for example, to feed back to like tell the experiment what is the optimal measurement to make next if we are, for example, performing state tomography. And particularly if we have access to these different kinds of local rotations for readout. Okay, so I've talked about this cavity QED cold atom platform and showed how we can tune the strength and sign of the interactions in this Heisenberg-Hamiltonian. And I've talked about some ideas of how we can use machine learning on this data, but I'm really interested in knowing if any of you have any other ones. So I'd like to thank my group. Our PI is Monica Schleyer-Smith, and the data here was taken by also Greg Benson, Avi Carr, and Eric. And I also want to advertise my poster that I'm presenting here with Zhaoyu Wang on calculating Rainy entropies in neural autoregressive quantum states. Thanks.
Why you set up, because we're a bit over time.
I probably missed it, but what did you say was the input to your machine, your preliminary machine learning application, where the machine was predicting theta. Did you feed dynamics?
Yeah, we fed it simulations of the mean field dynamics of the spins. So basically initializing in some state, calculating the average fx, fy, and fz components of the spins as a function of time, and then feeding that into the network.
Okay.